Welcome to the 54 Problems Podcast, the global mini golf podcast. Hear from some of the best players in the sport. Look ahead to some of the biggest tournaments and have a chance to win some amazing prizes. And now your hosts, Andrew Edmonds and Simon Brown.
Hello and welcome to the 54 Problems Podcast. I'm your co-host, Andrew Edmonds. Welcome one and all, and thank you so much for joining us. And with me, as always, is my good friend and co-host. You are never going to believe it. It's Simon Brown. Hello, Simon.
Hello, hello. As always, it's good to be back.
Yeah, good to see you. How are you, okay?
Yeah, I'm good, actually. I think this has been the longest gap since we began the podcast without an episode.
Yes.
So it actually feels quite alien to be back, but in a good way.
Well, I'll tell you why it's been such a big gap. It's because we've been hunting the ultimate guest. Someone that we've been hunting for quite a long time, but has proved elusive, has finally caved and joined us today. Is it the best guest ever? Is it the most ultimate guest? I suppose that's for our listeners to decide.
Yes, I mean, it's certainly somebody quite shy who doesn't court publicity, so teasing a few morsels out of them will be a first.
For the listeners' benefit, our special guest has just put their middle finger up to the camera.
Says all you need to know.
Okay, look, before we get out this illustrious guest, we just have time for my favourite part of the episode, which is where we thank our Patreon supporters for their support in us, helping us do this podcast and to keep it going and to keep it on the air. So thank you very much to champion of the podcast, Sevi Kukielka, for all your support over the months. And if you too would like to support the podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/54problems. That's 54s with the numbers. Okay, so joining us today, we have a three-time World Crazy Golf Championship winner and the winner of the Grand Slam Triple Crown. We've been hunting him for ages and he's finally caved and joined us. Please welcome to the 54 Problems Podcast, Mark Chapman. Hello, Mark.
Hi there, guys. How are we?
Yeah, very well, thank you. How are you?
Good, thanks.
So, Simon, run us through what we're going to be talking about today. Obviously, there's a huge range of topics we could be talking about with Mark, one of the ultimate champions of the sport.
Yeah, I think there's no better place than to jump straight into his achievements, because if you do know him, you'll know he's achieved plenty. If you don't, you'll be interested to know how much.
Yeah.
So, debut in 2009. With first wins in 2010. That was, I assume, the first win, Mark, would have been the Planet Hastings Open.
I think coming into it, I mean, my story's well documented how, you know, the World Crazies for me was the way in.
Sure.
It was my gateway drug into mini golf. And for me, like, joining the tour is quite daunting when you see there's an event and you really have no idea on what is going to take place, who are these people, how am I going to fit in, am I wearing the right gear? I know, Andrew, you had that issue on your first your first attempt.
Got it completely wrong, yeah.
So it's stuff like that, there's so much, you know, for you to get anxious about. And my first event ever was an informal gathering on New Year's Day at Hastings, out in the cold. It was absolutely frozen. It was frosty morning, and it was the first ever cupcake challenge. And I found out about it on an online forum, and they just said, "Oh yeah, just come on down." And I'd already purchased from Niffo in Sweden a putter and sort of starter set of Niffo balls. And just sort of rocked up, all wrapped up warm with this kit that I'd never used before. and just sort of mucked in, and they were really friendly. It was sort of the mixture of old Kent Mini Golf Club and Hastings lot, and they were really warm and welcoming. We played a few rounds outside. All the sort of classic characters were there, and it was quite enjoyable, and I played all right. I think a few people were like, oh, okay, he knows how to par. And then sort of it was, well, what's next? And then the tour started. It was Star City Open was my first ever sort of proper BMJ event. And at the now defunct course, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But the atmosphere there was very different to what it was on Hastings Seafront. So people were more intense. It felt like there was more on the line. People were chasing after prizes or ranking points, and for me that wasn't even on my radar at that stage. It was just turn up, and again I did all right. I learned a lot. I got to interact in practice with people like Chris Harding and you know these great ambassadors of the sport that have guided so many new players onto the tour, and I think I won top novice. I won a little fun sports, little green fun sports bag with a ball in it. I can't remember what it was.
Oh, nice.
I think it was a Yerny ball, actually. It must have been the British Open, one of the Yerny balls, which I still have.
It's a good prize.
Really good prize. Yeah. And that was a great sort of incentive. It's like, oh, okay, I've got something else to play with. Where do I go now? Where's the next event? And you just roll into the next event and the next event. And then at the end of a season, you suddenly have a ranking and you go, oh, okay, I'm above this player and this player, or, I'm so far behind this one. And how does it all work? And you start learning about the rules. You learn about how many qualifying events it takes to make up your score. And back then it was a real higgledy-piggledy system of rankings. I straddle what I class as sort of like the early days of British mini golf and where we are today. Before most of the players that are playing on tour are there now. It's like I was competing against Ted and Tim and Andy Exall, the Exalls, the whole Exall family back then. We were playing quite regularly and players that are no longer on tour. But then I kind of infected that atmosphere with my other sporting knowledge and sort of coaching skills, and my sort of, I was a top youth international fencer, so it was I brought that sort of slightly more obsessive compulsive, slightly more knowledgeable sort of background to how to develop my play and how to set goals and develop and progress and do things like that. One of the biggest sort of keys to success is discipline and consistency. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were just playing casually and then getting frustrated when they didn't score very well.
Right.
And then, I've been very consistent with my approach over the years from the start. With the equipment that I purchased, I bought the best.
Mm-hmm.
From the very start, before I'd even played a tournament, I made sure I had the right kit. That comes from fencing. That comes from my other, sporting background. Consistency in training. I've spoken to Simon on the course about this many times, and he's adapted his approach through our discussions and what we've, been enacting in practice. And, you need to try and simulate the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just by having a laugh and a joke and smack a few balls around and then go in under that intense pressure when this is the shot and it means everything, of course you're not going to be prepared, and it's left more to chance than to skill.
Yeah.
So I brought that sort of discipline, consistency to my practice and then to my play, and also celebrating the little wins, You've got to recognize that to get to the top level of anything takes time, and progress isn't linear. It's not just, a beautiful 45 degree angle on a graph. Over time, you will get there. Separating that, the performance from the result, the stat, the stat, my, how did I finish? What place did I get? And yes, there is a correlation. If I perform well, I should, in theory, get a better result. But it's not always like that, especially in a sport like fencing. Uh-huh. You know, I have fenced utter shit throughout an event and still come out of it in a final medaling or whatever, because it's a clash of styles. It's you versus another person. It's who wants it more. You know, you might not be as skillful as the other person. You might not be as experienced as the other person. You get this in match play mini golf quite a lot. And it's understanding that you can still perform okay and get an amazing result, but it could go the other way as well. You can perform okay and just get a really bad run, or the result is rubbish because other people have played better than you. So there's this, yeah, this separation of performance and result, this understanding of controllables, things that I can control, things that are completely out of my control. How many people do you play with that moan about what this person's doing and that thing and the wind and the rain, or this, the conditions of the hole, the cup, the robbing cups and the metal lips and all of this? And it's just like, well, it's the same for me. It's the same for me. So what's, you know, you're getting wound up about something and that is going to have an effect on your performance. So I bring all of that side to it. I was, you know, I believe I was one of the first to think that way. You know, a true sort of performance attitude to my play. And as a result, over the years, I've built some momentum and been able to put myself into positions to win things.
And year two, of course, you won Planet Hastings and you won the British doubles in 2010. Before going
That was huge. Doubles was huge for me.
Mm-hmm.
It really was, like, it's a really fun, friendly event. I know the individual titles are what people sort of count, but for me, I played with Chris Harding for a few years, and we won twice out of British doubles. That was huge for my development. Absolutely massive. To ride on his coattails, and he'll back me up on this, I was rubbish the first year we won. I didn't perform particularly well in the key matches. I think I performed well in sort of the group stages, but then in the semi-final final, I was carried on him massively. But just getting the win, getting over the line, that gave confidence. Those sort of small wins, like I talk about, you know, people don't really hold the doubles up the same esteem as the World Crazy Golf Championships. Of course not. Mm. You know, rightly so. But at the time, that was the biggest thing I'd won. So you've got to take that, and you've got to learn from that, and you've got to feel what it's like to be in those key matches, those finals, or you know, to be in the final group. You're not going to get it right the first time. I certainly didn't. I was just lucky that Chris Harding is just an absolute beast around those courses. Then the second win, I must add, the second time we won, I carried him. So he will admit again, the shoe was on the other foot. But that's what a partnership is. What a team is. You have to, you know, you won't both be firing 100% all the time. And if you are, God help the people you're playing.
Sure.
Yeah, so that second win was the next year in 2011, by which time you've kicked on massively. You've won the British Open. And you've won the Masters in 2011. So you went within 2 years, 2.5 years, from just being happy to participate to claiming a doubles as the weaker player in a partnership to winning two of the four biggest events. That is, people don't do it in that time scale.
No.
Did you feel that was huge to do that in 2.5 years?
Good question. I mean, I could go through them individually. I mean, Planet Hastings is not the Planet Hastings tournament we have today. Planet Hastings back then was four courses. So around on four different courses. You had Clambers, you had the old mini course, the adventure course, which no one ever played, and the Crazies, which everyone knew. So Clambers and the Crazies, everyone knew. The mini was love-hate for people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the adventure was just, you know, well, we'll just do it. Everyone will shoot like 38, 40. You know, it won't really make a difference on the final score. I think that one, I took it right through to a playoff against Tim. So we were tied after four, and the final round was up at Clambers. And you know, I'd watch all the videos. I watched the Nutters with Putters, like promos and stuff, and seeing Tim just ace ridiculous shots around Clambers course back then. Mm. And ironically, the playoff went to hole two, I think it was back then, which is one of the iconic holes for Tim, where he'd play sort of like this slow shot and it would just fall down the hill in sort of a parabolic curve. And it would deflect off this sort of stone wall, sort of brick wall, back towards the hole where it would loop in. So you'd need a quite a heavy ball, quite sort of medium-sized ball, something with a good bit of bounce to it. And he had something unique that seemed to work with him. And I'd specifically found a ball for that hole for that tournament. And he missed it and I aced it for the win. So, again, not many people can say that they can they beat Tim Davis on his home course on a hole that he would say is one of his signature shots historically. It's quite legendary. So that was massive and he hated it. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I bet.
Some of the photos of the prize giving are hilarious. So that was a massive event to win.
So after those first two or three years playing, you took a little bit of a break. I know you didn't have as much time and you wanted to work on your grip and your swing. When you came back from that break, you won your first World Crazy Golf Championship, sort of coming in under the radar. I'm interested to get your thoughts on this, because now when you play and you enter the World Crazy Golf Championship, you're most definitely not under the radar. You've got your own brand, your own identity, sort of a bit of a celebrity within the sport. What do you prefer? Did you prefer that first win where you sort of under the radar, or do you like where you are now with having your brand and identity?
Yeah, I think that first World Crazy win, it was definitely an advantage to come under the radar. You know, Michael was just rampant on tour for those years that I wasn't really around. I was one of a few players that could, you know, I would feel that I was able to compete on equal terms with him, you know, and Adam. You know, how many tournaments have I been to when sort of you rock up and you're sat with players waiting to start and they say, oh, Michael's here, we're playing for second place. And sure. I never had that attitude. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so coming in there, definitely an advantage coming in the radar. But then, obviously, you're now World Crazy Golf Champion. And then suddenly people go, oh, yeah, he's quite good. I remember he used to win stuff and now he's back and he's played well. So every year is different. Every year is a different challenge. And for me, it was a new challenge, you know, having a baby and just trying to find a balance, sleep, etc., and concentration levels and all of these things. And, you know, the positives, I'm still able to get myself into contention for things. It just so happens that last year I probably didn't sort of see them through like I used to for various reasons. People playing awesomely, maybe me being a bit complacent in some occasions, maybe, you know, lack of sleep affected concentration when it comes to the final round, final holes, stuff like that. You know, I'm human, not a machine. I'm not Michael. yeah, it's you know, in terms of me building a following, you know, when you become World Crazy Golf Champion, I think more so than any other title, you get requests, you get garner media attention, radio, television, etc. In the same way that Tim used to, Tim Davies. And, you know, I made a decision to try and exploit that for monetary reasons, you know, see whether I could monetize it, see if it could get me into other areas like it has, course designing, media work, a bit of corporate work, working with courses. It's just, why not? You know, I've got a self-employed part of my fencing coaching business. It made sense to sort of tag it onto that and see how far I could take it. And anyone that finds themselves in that position, you know, you don't have a choice. You become an ambassador for mini golf. That's, you know, you have a platform. And it's down to you to decide how to use that platform. And I decided to go down that route. And I think I've been quite effective. I think I've been more effective than most people to make those connections and work with the media and get that message out there. You know, don't get me wrong. Like, all you see is probably about 10% of the effort to open those doors, bang down, you know, break down walls, change perception of people of Crazy Golf from just that sort of gimmick interview piece where it's sort of like, and finally, let's have a laugh at these guys. So trying to build that respect. And there's something in the pipeline to be released, hopefully this year, a proper full-length documentary about mini golf. Some people I've sent the trailer to. It's quite exciting. It's done in a way where I was able to control the edit, you know, control the direction and make sure that they were doing it the right way and not making it a clowning around piece. So I really hope when it does surface that, you know, everyone has the opportunity to see it. I think the idea is to have a premiere somewhere and invite the whole mini golf community to that. So, yeah, there's stuff like that. You know, I would never have the opportunity to do that.
So then after your 3 years, well, it was actually 4 years of dominance because of COVID, you held the title from 2018 to 2022 at the Crazies, and that's given you the opportunity to go down these avenues and try to make yourself an ambassador if you wanted to. How did it actually feel to lose it to Adam? Does that inspire you to come back? Did it just feel like it was time for someone else?
Yeah, as I've already outlined, last year was different for a few reasons. I played really well. I played really well in terms of my performance. You know, when you look at it, I think I only lost, what was it, 2-shot difference in the end, something like that. And I didn't have one of those. I normally have a killer round. I didn't have one last year. Whereas Adam, I think, had his killer round first round, was like 28 or something. So when you look at it, the difference, you know, the difference is 2 shots. And when you look at the previous years, the difference has been a couple of shots. So we, you know, there's no coincidence. It's the same players up there year in, year out. I've gone on record with this before. It's just a consequence of those guys' experience on the course. It takes a long time to learn the nuances and the way the course plays when the wind changes, when the sun's out, when it's damp in the morning, what time you're playing during the day. You've got to build up a decade of experience of playing in all conditions to be fully prepared for that weekend. I played really well. I was a few shots behind. I had a roaring first 9 holes, brought it back level. I think like we were at hole 10, we were level. So I'd brought it back. I was on his shoulder. I was firing. And then I'm normally so strong from like 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's my bread and butter. And I wasn't. That is the one bit, and I come back to this energy to sustain the concentration for the last few holes of the last round of a full weekend. And that's where, on reflection, I lacked compared with previous years. And that will be down to baby. 100%. That's down to not having the cumulative good sleep in the week before the event.
So yeah, looking forward then to attempting to get it back this year. You've mentioned your practice schedule and the fact that, you know, you have a set thing you'd go through, and I know how much you prepare for events, and I won't knock it because you're successful. So I seen you come to Wales when you decided to enter a title in Wales, and we used to sneakily find you there doing what you do. And then on the weekend, you put in performances and scores that we don't put in. So I know it has success for you. So how do you prepare? What practice schedule do you put in place? Because I think it is something that we don't do, that the other players don't do.
So you want the secrets? when you want the dark arts of Mark Chapman mini golf. Let's say we've got a brand new course. So let's say, here we go. Simon, you've just opened your brand new course. You know, shame it's only 8 holes, but, you know, I'm sure you'll get there in the end for the other 10. But, okay, we've got this course here. How am I going to approach it? Okay, well, first of all, I'm going to have a little walk through. I'm going to see sort of what there is, what the flow of the course is like. Then, you know, I'll start somewhere where it interests me. It might not necessarily be on hole one. I'll just start somewhere where I think, okay, right, this one. I'll look at a hole and I think in my head, right, that's the shape of shot I want. You know, I'm looking for a rebound here. I'm looking to play it dead weight. So I have my stock balls that I'll go to and, you know, start with those and see if they're a good fit. And then I'll tinker, you know, it needs more bounce. It needs more weight. It needs to be bigger. It needs whatever. So then I'll start the tinkering and I'll just stay on that hole and I'll just play that hole again and again and again and again. And I will play not with no mind. Okay. It's got to be with mind. So everything has to be the right focus. So every time I place the ball down, it will be like I am playing the shot in the tournament. So I'm sitting here now visualizing. So I've got my ball, I'm placing it down there. I'm standing over the shot. I know the shot I'm going to play. I'm going to breathe. I'm going to do my pre-shot routine. I'm going to strike the ball. I'm going to see where it ends up. And then I can analyze when I've hit it. Did I hit it right? You know, did I jiff it? Did I whatever? Like, did I play that as well as I can play it? And then after you played it a few times, you then know the true feedback of that shot, that line, that ball, whatever it is. And then, you know, you take something, you go, okay, that'll do for now. Then I'll move on. I'll do the same for the other holes. So now I've got 8 holes of notes. Then I'll play around playing those things and just see how it was at. And then I'll go back and I'll probably tinker again. And then if I've got another day, you know, if I come back for another training day, I'll go back. I'll play what I played before and then sort of start thinking more about average score. Because obviously it's not just one round. It's not just one hole. You're going to play, you know, Cardiff Open, 3 rounds. Well, crazy, 7 rounds. So you're going to have some amazing rounds. You're going to have some average rounds. Hopefully no poor rounds. What's my average score going to be? And comparing that to what previous average scores have been on those courses. So then I'll analyze that. I have a little spreadsheet. I'll go back home with my notes, transfer my notes to my Excel document. I'll do, you know, some practice rounds, try and feel where the average score sits, and then look at the holes and look at the holes one by one and go, well, okay, I'm up on that hole. I'm down on that hole. I should be better on that hole. And then you can focus on, instead of focusing on all 8 holes, I'm now maybe only focusing on 3 holes where I need to make that change. And that change might bring my average down by a shot.
Something I want to touch on. So you offer advice to players. You've offered plenty of advice to me over the years. Some I've asked for, some I haven't. And I came around to, for the most part, understanding the good intentions, and you've given some great advice. Like, you used to just point out, why are you still playing with the knee full double? And you used to actually seem passionately annoyed about it. And you had a point. And it took me 3.5 years to figure that out. So it's well-intentioned advice. But you can be a bit of a divisive character. And I hope you don't mind me saying that, because I think I fall into that at times. So, you know, on the course, you have a way, when you're focused and you're performing well, you come across as quite arrogant from the outside. And then when you give advice, you're so strong in your own convictions of the advice you give that it... How do you feel you come across, and how do you feel that others perceive you? Do you care?
Don't really. I'm a bit like the Dark Knight of mini golf. I'm, you know, yes, you're playing the same tournament as me, but I'm playing against myself. I'm playing against the course. You know, you just happen to be there. You know, that's very much, I'm there to do a job. That, you know, in the tournament, I'm in tournament mode. I'm very different. You know me. Like, in practice mode, you know what I'm like. I will chew the fat. I will joke. I will mess around. I will pick up my ball and maybe not even play some holes, you know. Tournament mode, yeah, different beast. You've got to have a high-performance mindset when you play these events. Otherwise, at the end, you have absolutely no right to sit there and complain about your result and them winning and you not winning this and whatever. So I make sure I leave everything out there. And, you know, you just happen to be there. You know, it's no slight on you or the way I feel about you. It's just that I am so into what I'm doing that, and you know, we talk about, you know, giving advice with conviction and borderline, you know, confident / arrogant. What I do works. So I have my method. I have my process. It works for me. It might not work for you, but I think you owe it to yourself to maybe listen and try it and tinker with it yourself and make it your own. That's on you. Yes, it sounds arrogant, but I've got the stats to back it up. I'm chasing titles. I'm not there to play for fun. I'm sorry. I'm there to rack up some more trophies. I'm there to push myself and beat my scores from last year. I'm there to challenge myself against the very best and try and come out on top. And if I don't, ask anyone that's been up against me head-to-head. I'm the first person to congratulate. I am pleased for the person to be able to put in a performance that is able to take me down. Yeah, no skin off my back. If you play better than me, you deserve to win. That's not arrogant. That's just, I know I'm experienced enough. I know I'm good enough to win these things. I've got the trophy sat right there to prove it. Yeah, that Cardiff Open title's sitting right there. yeah, it's, you know, shouting on the course. We might come to this a bit later, but mini golf's not a sterile environment. You know, there's kids, there's seagulls, there's noise, there's shouting. It's not a sterile environment. If you play for fun and you do something good, then surely you're going to cheer and shout about it. You can't have it both ways. I think a lot of people have a preconception of what mini golf should be, in a sense, in order to justify to themselves why they're not playing as well as they think they should be. So it's always somebody else's fault, or it's always the fact that I'm standing there being a big presence, or a bit, well, who cares? You know, what are you going to do to influence your game, to control your controllables? What are you going to do to perform better than me? Because I know what I'm doing. I'm very confident in what I'm doing. And I'm not one of these players from the old school that is going to come and make a shadow over your ball or try and put you off in a malicious way. Sure. You know, I don't do gamesmanship. I don't need to do gamesmanship if I'm playing well. You understand? No, I just have great self-belief. And that belief is reinforced by the fact that I go out and I perform and I win.
So you say you don't do gamesmanship, and I believe you. You're not the type to, you know, cast a shadow, literally or metaphorically, over the game. But
that's good.
There is, of course, the nigh on iconic ace call. The go on, give us one now. Give us a come on.
I don't know. I'm a bit blocked up, but it's the guttural sort of yeah, and then sort of come on. It just, it's very natural for me. I don't do it as much as I probably used to, because like when you're climbing the slippery slope of like mini golf, like when you're on it, but now it's a bit old hat. Like I know I can play well. So no, like in a way you need to be more fearful if you hear a cheer from me across the course, because it means I must be outdoing myself and my own expectations, or it's a hole that like I really am anxious about, or I really want to execute well, and I have. Yeah, it's an ace call. It's. I'm not doing it like I'm not consciously doing it as well. So like,
there's no element of projecting your success across the course.
No. I've done a great shot, and I'm riding the adrenaline rush of nailing that shot, and it's guttural. I can't stop it. It like when it goes in, like, I've done it. And if it just so happens that you are playing a shot across the course and you're just about to hit the ball when I go, yeah, well, of course I didn't. I'm not watching what you're doing.
Yep.
And you're more than welcome to give it, you know, give as good as you get type thing. I'm not one for these sort of sterile environments. If you've done something well, celebrate it. It's a little win. Celebrate it. That's where the joy comes from. The joy comes from the smile, the instinctive reactions to how you're playing or how your playing partner plays. Someone plays an amazing shot with me, I will shout as well. You know, that's happened a few times on courses, and I've heard tuts and sort of shh across the course. And I just, like, come on. Like, it's mini golf. It's the game. It's not sterile.
Sure. On this podcast today, you're speaking to two people, you know, let's set aside talent for 1 second, two people that share your passion for the game, that don't mind being bigger characters and being more divisive and putting themselves out there. And it is a smaller breed in mini golf, particularly at the top end. People that actually want to compete for titles that will be this loud and this big as a character. And I think sometimes, because, you know, when you're not about and we are set against the endless winning machine of Michael and how quiet and humble he is when he does it, that makes your approach, when the way you win, when you show up, it makes it set at odds with what we see. And, you know, we've had Seve come through now and he wins plenty. And, you know, he's up at the top end. He's as humble as anybody. Do you think, you know, it's just that lack of outward passion at the top end that maybe sets you aside and makes you look like the outlier? Because I think if me and Andrew were in your position, I think we would be as outspoken and as loud as you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it comes down to characters and personality. And, you know, it's not their fault if that's not the way that they instinctively behave. That's them. You know, again, I've used the example before. Look at the top tennis players. Look at, like, racing car drivers. Look at, you know, you've got that mix of personalities. And that creates its own narrative. As hopefully you'll see this documentary that comes out, you know, you will dive into the different characters and you'll see their backgrounds. We've gone to a lot of the top players and gone to their homes and seen how they live and you know, what makes them tick. And, you know, what makes me tick is different to what makes Michael tick, is different to what makes you tick. And there has to be an allowance of the humanity. Andrew, where's the humanity in mini golf? Yes, this is huge. We need to be marketable. We need to be, you know, visible when we play the tournaments in a public eye. It needs to appear like we're having fun, or it's entertaining, or it's dramatic. Not just for drama's sake, okay? Not creating the drama in a false way, but allowing the personalities to blossom with an activity that we all love and enjoy. And that is then what people can tap into. This is why we still tell stories about Tim and Ted. This is why we tell stories. You know, they're characters. They are people that did things their way, and I respect it. I'm doing it differently. You're doing it differently. And we must be allowed the space to grow and nurture that and find our own path.
Simon, any final questions before we get into getting to know you?
So just a couple of things I don't think are in getting to know you questions. Mm-hmm. What is your, a sort of simultaneous yin and yang question, what is your proudest moment and what is your biggest regret in mini golf?
Well, you know, I could say winning my first world title. I think that's right up there. I could maybe say being the first British player to win the British Open. I think that's something that no one else will ever be able to say. But my proudest moment is knocking Michael Smith out the first round of the match play singles at Worthing back in, I think it was 2011 or 2012. And we went to a playoff hole. And people that have played there at Splash Point at Worthing, big shout out to those guys. There's a hole called the Bridge of Sighs, which is a little like ramp between, like, the hole's only like 2 meters away from you from the tee, and there's this little ramp with two little bunkers either side. Or most people chicking out, they play around the bunkers and do like a double rebound off the corner of the wall.
Disgusting.
And try and just lay it up next to the hole and knock it in. But this was match play. And this was sudden death against Michael Smith. So I just bashed it right over the thing into the cup and knocked him out. And then I promptly went out, I think, the next round to someone. I can't remember. But yeah, I'm going to put that up there. I'm going to say that shot on that occasion... that for me is a very, very moment, very proud moment.
Final question before we start getting to know you. What's going in Ambrose's hand first? Is it a mini golf putter or is it a fencing foil?
Putter.
Putter, nice one. All right. Mark, are you ready for some quick fire questions?
Oh, if I have to, go on.
Then this is getting to know you.
Getting to know you.
Do you have a mini golf nickname, and if so, where does it come from?
I was Mark Chappers Chapman, first of all, because it was a bit obvious and no one bothered to give me a nickname. And then I actually put forward the Force. I was thinking more like Feel the Power or something like this. So I put that forwards and sort of forced it through in my usual manner. And luckily it stuck. So, so it's Mark the Force Chapman.
All right. What is your greatest achievement? It doesn't have to be your most high profile tournament win or your lowest score. Just what makes you the most proud when you look back? What jumps into your head first?
Beaking Michael Smith in match play. No. My biggest achievement, I mean, not mini golf, you were saying, sorry.
It's just greatest achievement.
Ever, full stop.
So what makes you the most proud when you look back? Yeah, that's what I've got written here.
Okay. I obviously, you know, having my son, I think, like, that is... I'd get shot if I didn't say that. but then there's the standard dad response, isn't it, for anyone? Sure. I think for me, like with mini golf, like winning the Dunton Open, that's my first win as a dad. Mm-hmm. And if you look at history on the tour, you know, to be able to win like pre having a kid and post having a kid, I think is amazing. It's that for me, that was a big moment, because a bit of a monkey on my back, like psychologically, it's changed. To be able to do it and still do it, that was massive for me. So I think the next one will be obviously going and playing in this year's World Crazies and having him there watching me. I think that might be the first time he'd be toddling around then, so probably give him a little putter and stuff. I think that... his first ace, that will top it.
Yeah, sure. Were his first words, come on?
They were dada.
That'd be good, wouldn't it?
I'm quids in.
I like that answer. You gave a little bit of the dad answer and a little bit of the mini golf answer. So there you go. You managed to make them both work. What is your advice to new players? And it can't be to just enjoy the game and have fun, because we found that everyone used to say that. So apart from that, what is your advice to new players?
Well, it's definitely not to just have fun. For me, it is just play in practice the way you feel you'll be playing in tournament mode. So when you put that ball down, just pause. Don't just smack it with no mind. You have to be present every single shot you play. You have to be consciously aware of what you're doing. And then, you know, secondary to that is get the best equipment you can from the start. Don't just think, oh, save 10 quid and get this rubbish putter with a metal base that's going to click the top of the ball.
Yeah.
Just you owe it to yourself. It's not expensive. You know, one of the top putters is like 90, 100 quid. Get it. You'll save yourself so much misery, especially when you're paying, you know, 18, 20 quid a ball. Just get a good putter from the start. The balls will come in time, but get yourself a proper flathead putter with a rubber on it. Just get a pro putter. Honestly, like, I'm sitting here now, like, smacking my forehead. You have to do it. You owe it to yourself. Like, be kind to yourself and give yourself a head start by using the right stuff. And then little wins, you know? Enjoy the journey. For some people, the journey is longer than others to get to a point where you feel like you're in control. But celebrate those little wins, those little triumphs. And be vocal about it. Don't be shy. You know, okay. share the joy, share the love.
What is your favourite course?
I mean, for me, I've got a few. It's difficult. They're like different children of mine. I love Hastings. I love that crazy course. It's just a classic. I really hope they stop changing the holes away from the original character.
Mm-hmm.
And preserve what they've got there. There's no reason to do what they did on hole two other holes. Sure. I understand why, but for me, it's a heritage course. If a building, it would be listed. You know, it's that sort of level for me. And then strokes is a one-off. It's an absolute beast of a course. It has those killer holes. You could play stroke play, match play, team play. It doesn't matter what you play on that course. You will have a narrative. You will have highs and lows. To win at that course, you have to be a top, top player. And again, you look at the list of winners over the years, from, you know, the foreign players that used to play the British Open there to, you know, the Brits, Masters, Opens, all sorts of things we've had there. Anyone that's played, you look at it, you just go, that's no fluke. You are a top, top player. So yeah, those two are obviously the standouts for me.
Okay. If you could travel in time, you can go forward in time or backward in time, but you can only go to one place. You have to pick one place in time. And you do get to come back afterwards, so you don't have to worry about returning back to your family. Where would you go? Would you go forward in time or backwards in time?
Yeah, I think I'll go forwards. Yeah. I think I'll go forwards a couple of years. Okay. And, you know, I've got two options here.
Okay.
I'll do the classic fighting talk, give you a number of options before I nail down the final one. So we've got this new tour in Scandinavia that's sort of getting traction. So for me, I'm keen to go out and play in a few of these things.
Okay.
Maybe not this year. I'm going to try to, but maybe not this year. It might be in the coming years.
Sure.
So, you know, let's go forward 2-3 years. This thing's gained some traction. I'm, you know, I'm in contention for these things and playing really well. That makes me smile inside. And nice. Then if we went a few years further, let's say we go down the line, we're sort of like eight, nine years away, then I'm playing a tournament with my son. And I think that for me, like, I want to keep playing. I've always said this, I want to play until I drop when I can. But to be able to play with him and pass on my knowledge to him and pass on the love and enjoyment of the sport to him, that's a massive mission for me. And then obviously coach him to be the best in the world on Etonet and felt and stuff. That would just be like incredible.
What is your mini golf hottest take? What opinion do you have about mini golf? Say if you walked into a room of mini golf players and you said one thing, what would it be that would cause the most turned heads and the most consternation?
Only one. yeah, I'm not shy about giving opinions about things. There's many topics that I feel quite strongly within the game.
So pick one that you feel has the most sort of disagreement or...
Pushback.
Yeah, pushback.
I would love a tournament where only the top players compete against each other for big money in the UK.
Okay.
Like a closed event where people have to pre-qualify.
Yeah. Okay. That's it.
I think that, yeah, I think that for me, like, if you want to look at the progression of mini golf in this country, mm-hmm. I think if you had, you know, like, for example, like a British Championships, but like a, you could call it something different, and, you know, only the top 16 in the rankings go. And that is something maybe you could market, televise, whatever, just do it on YouTube as part of the BMGA, you know, because people obviously aren't going to travel across the country, spend stay overnight to go and watch. But maybe you could have it bolted onto a major or something like that as a little something, in the same way you do like the Players' Championships the day before. That's kind of a bit of a closed event, in the way that it has a cut and it selects like round by round. Something like that, you know, like a Players' Championship, but in a stroke play format, and just like the best of the best of that season. Yeah, I think that'd be awesome.
That sounds great. So now we've reached the part of the episode where we shine a spotlight onto one of Mark's balls. Mark, this is ball spotlight. First of all, how many mini golf balls do you have?
I must have, oh God, I must have close to 400.
Okay, well, and can you pick one that is particularly memorable to you, you're fond of, your heart is close to? If you had to pick one to share with us in ball spotlight, which one would it be?
Well, again, I could be very obvious here and just go for my own ball of fame. I've got a 3D ball of fame from 2011 British Open,
sure,
which is just a standard stock ball. Everyone should have it in their bag. And then I've got the newer one, which is the British Championships ball from M&G, which is a pretty much the same, but just lower bounce. So you can give it a bit more if the ball's closer to a wall. So those balls are too obvious for me. I'm going to go a bit niche.
Nice.
I absolutely love playing on the foreign courses with these like hard sort of 14 centimeter, 16 centimeter bounces. So you've got these holes on Etonet, and on Beton, where you just hammer a ball into a rail, really close to where you tee off from. So maybe only like, I don't know, a foot, 3 foot maximum away from where you tee off from. You just absolutely tonk the thing into the wall, and let this hard ball do the work. And it's on a hole like called Labyrinth, on the Etonet, yeah, or on, yeah, hole 18 on the concrete course with the letterbox, where you just ram it in and it goes up a ramp. I love that thing. Mm-hmm. I don't use it as often as I should do here in the UK, but just like something that's like 90, 95 to 100 sure, can be any sort of weight, fairly light, but sort of has a bounce around that sort of 14 to sort of 20 centimetres. I wish I could find more use for it in the UK, but I love that kind of ball. Like a, it's called like a special ball. What is it called? Granite, like a granite ball. Yeah.
All right. Look, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing everything. I found it massively interesting. I'm sure the people listening will have done as well. So thank you so much for joining us today. Simon, any final words?
Yeah, thanks again from me. Just always open,
yep,
honest, insightful, and nothing if not strong-minded. I think that's the one thing you can take away from this, if you listen to it, is there's nothing up with having conviction in your own opinions. Because if you look at Mark, he wins with those opinions and that conviction.
Mark, have you enjoyed your time on the 54 Problems podcast?
Yeah, thanks guys for having me. Pleasure. It's been taking you a while, but yeah. from my home in Canterbury, you know, best wishes to all players for the new season, wherever you are around the world.
Cool, thank you very much. So with that said, all that's left to say is goodbye from Simon.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Mark.
Yeah, come on.
There we go. He did it eventually. And it's goodbye from me. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.